From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, can Texas desal its way out of the drought?
Digging a hole and praying for rain is not an answer, and that's basically what we've done in the past.
And after the lesser prairie chicken is listed as a federally protected species, some are crying foul over the voluntary plan to save the native bird.
The population is in real trouble, a total collapse, unless it's afforded the full protection of the Endangered Species Act right now.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. How can Texas be short on water when we have an entire coastline with access to the stuff? All we need to do is set up some desalination plants and start pumping. Problem solved, right? Well, no. Desal water is much more expensive than the water Texans are accustomed to having access to. But as Texas is seeing a growing scarcity of fresh water and more reservoirs going dry and aquifer levels dropping and communities going on mandatory water restrictions, desal, despite the expense, is looking more and more attractive. Kyle Frazier is the executive director of the Texas Desalination Association.
I would never say it was a complete solution. I would say it was part of a solution. We've got, and this has been ongoing for a number of years, with the increased population and what's happening, and whether you believe in global warming or don't believe in global warming, or it's man-made or it's not, all it's kind of irrelevant at this point. We do know that it's getting warmer, and it's certainly been getting drier here in Texas over the last several years. Near as we can tell, long-term, that trend doesn't appear to be changing, so we're going to have to look at water in a different way. We've enjoyed very inexpensive water across the state for a long time, and those days are probably past. And everyone, all communities, I think, are going to have to start looking at other options, and that would include conservation, reuse, and desalination as part of a water portfolio instead of just depending on one source.
How does desal work?
Desal typically, and the technology is always improving, but in its most basic form, desal is taking the water and running it through, forcing it through a series of membranes of varying sizes, which pull out the different mineral elements that might be in the water, and then producing water that's drinkable. And depending on how salty the water is, whether it's seawater or whether it's what we refer to as brackish water, which is groundwater that's salty, the cost of running the water through the membranes and power to push that water through the membranes is one of the overriding costs in that, determines whether or not how economical that particular water might be.
And what do you do with the stuff you get out of it?
The concentrate. Then that's an excellent question, because we have not. If you're talking about ocean desal, and this is, none of this is new. I mean, other parts of the world have been desalinating water for many, many years and doing it quite successfully. But if you're talking about ocean desal, the concentrate typically is remixed back in the ocean to varying degrees, and a lot of it just depends on the intake and the outflow. And your intake, you have to be aware of marine animals and the environment within the ocean, and carefully how you do your intake and your outflow. Most studies show that if you do your outflow in certain areas of the ocean, then you really don't impact the, because of course you're just putting salty water back in salty water. Brackish water, which is the groundwater that is salty with underground, is a little bit of a different issue And again, certainly in Texas, because we don't do a lot of that, we really the only we've got two sizable brackish water plants in the state. One is out in El Paso, the K. Bailey Hutchison plant, which is actually the largest brackish water plant in the world, and produces a sizable amount of water. They actually take that take the concentrate and they remix it further downstream in an underground aquifer. And the water that they're putting it in, that they're mixing in, is actually the water they're putting in there, the concentrate putting in there, is actually cleaner than the where they're putting it in. And Brownsville does something similar. Brownsville is the other large desal plant in Texas that desals brackish water, and then they also reblend. And that's a fairly common method, is to reblend with basically saltier water. One of the other options is to take the concentrate and put it in a deep injection well. And we really haven't done a tremendous amount of that, just simply because we haven't done a tremendous amount of brackish desal in the state of Texas, but that is certainly an option. Now, there are some other technologies out there that are currently being looked at and being pilot tested to do some more innovative things with the concentrate, and certainly as this technology, as more and more communities make use of this technology, then I think a good answer is going to come to that concentrate use and finding a good economical and environmentally sensitive way to handle it.
Desal from brackish water, you wouldn't have to go to the Gulf of Mexico if you're in West Texas. So no need for a long pipeline then.
One of the things that's being looked at, and if you look at a brackish water map, and our Texas Water Development Board has that. The brackish water is scattered in a variety of areas all over the state, and so there are many communities where it would be readily available. And some of these communities would be able to drill within their own area, put in a desal plant, and provide it for their own community. One of the things that's being looked at to make this even more economical is to look at it from a regional source, where a number of communities might go in together, drill a well or series of wells, put in a brackish plant, and then use that a brackish desal plant, and then use that plant to supply all of those partnering communities with some portion of their water. Certainly, transportation is always a factor, and it figures into the overall economic impact of this technology. The shorter distance that you have to pump it, to move it, obviously you're going to save costs. But there will be some instances where it will need to be moved. But at least at this point, I don't think anybody's envisioning long drawn out pipelines.
And so, what would it cost for, say, 1,000 gallons of water that came out of a desal plant?
Typical, and there are a lot of variables, obviously, power being a big part of that, and I'll touch on that as well. But you can, as a rule of thumb, you can look at an estimate of brackish water being somewhere between $2 and $4 per 1,000 gallons, and seawater being somewhere between $3 and $6 per 1,000 gallons. And as I said, there are a whole host of variables that will impact those numbers. But that's a kind of a good general rule of thumb to live by. One of the things that we're looking at. And there are a number of different entities that are considering this. And again, power being one of your major cost drivers, is doing something we call co-locating, where you put the power plant and the desal plant together behind the same fence, basically, where you cut down on your transmission costs, where the power plant might be dedicated to the desal plant, and they run the desal plant at night, and then the power plant becomes a peak plant, which sells power to the grid during peak hours or during the day, which would obviously cut down on your transmission costs and your power costs, but also allow the power plant to provide additional electricity to the grid, and that's something that's being looked at very closely.
You said between $2 and $4 per 1,000 gallons for brackish water desal, and it's usually you get water now out of my utility. It's about 25 cents per 1,000 gallons.
Sure.
So that's quite a huge increase in cost.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. It's going to cost more. And I was at a conference, a water conference, a summer before last, and one of the speakers said that as long as our cable bill is more expensive than our water bill, our priorities are messed up. And I think that's very accurate. The days when we've had very inexpensive water are probably on the way out, and there's no question we're going to have to rethink the way we use our water, and we're going to have to rethink how much we pay for it. But when your option is turning on the tap and getting nothing, then $1.50 or $2 per 1,000 gallons is actually pretty cheap.
Kyle Frazier is the executive director of the Texas Desalination Association. A growing number of water utilities in Texas are considering and planning adopting desal. The lesser prairie chicken is now officially a threatened species, and on May 1st, new federal protections take effect, set up to prevent the extinction of the native fowl. But industry leaders are grousing that the protections will interfere with oil and gas drilling and the construction and operation of wind farms. But scientists and environmentalists are crowing just the opposite. They say the prairie chicken protections, which rely on voluntary compliance, are inadequate, and many are calling for full endangered listing protections for the prairie chicken. Jay Leinecker is a senior scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity.
The lesser prairie chicken is a smallish to medium-sized brown bird. The males have magnificently colored plumage. They weigh about a pound and a half to 2 pounds as adults. And they engage in very unique, sometimes humorous, courtship displays in the springtime that involve utterances like booming and very funny dances that make this a very unique species that's entertaining to watch.
But we're losing them. They are endangered.
Lesser prairie chicken populations plummeted by half to under 18,000 individuals in 2013, largely due to drought. And the population is in real trouble of total collapse unless it's afforded the full protection of the Endangered Species Act right now.
So, but the federal government is giving it some protection, right? Didn't they recently announce that?
The recently announced decision of the Fish and Wildlife Service is to protect the lesser prairie chicken on paper, but not on the ground. The voluntary measures and state-level conservation plans on which the service relies sets a very low population goal of only 67,000 birds. That size of a population won't be sufficiently resilient to drought or other natural disturbances, and the voluntary conservation agreements are unenforceable. So there's no guarantee that these measures will get traction fast enough to prevent extinctions.
Now, there are people who are saying that that this is a ruse, that this is actually the Texas Railroad Commissioner David Porter dismisses the threatened designation of the lesser prairie chicken as just another part of President Obama's war on fossil fuel.
Well, the Texas Railroad Commission and the oil and gas industry stridently resist any regulation, even at the cost of extinction. I don't think that oil and gas dollars necessarily follow the public interest, particularly when we're talking about the natural heritage that all Americans are entitled to enjoy in this generation and in future ones.
Well, what's the conflict? Why is there something disturbing the oil and gas industry if we try to protect the lesser prairie chicken?
Well, that's a fantastic question, because intelligent energy development and lesser prairie chicken populations can coexist. The chickens are disrupted by tall structures such as oil and gas towers, wind energy turbines. So we can place energy infrastructure at locations that won't disrupt chicken populations and still enable the kind of economic boom that people have come to enjoy and expect.
So what would you like to see happen with protections for the lesser prairie chicken?
Well, first off, the lesser prairie chicken needs to be fully protected under the Endangered Species Act. That means no exemptions for activities that can fragment their habitat or destroy it.
But what would that entail? What would that mean? You know, we would have to, set up reserves for them? Don't we already have some?
Yeah, so focal areas need to be much larger. The areas that are actually protected from development need to be at least the size required for breeding populations. And those actually amount to postage stamps, only about 20,000 acres, and that's less than the campus of Disney World in Florida. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the conservation measures built into the plans need to be enforceable. That is, you don't build roads or well pads in occupied breeding lacs. And thirdly, we need to keep habitat in place where it exists. You don't want to destroy habitat today with the promise of finding habitat somewhere else in the future without knowing where that's going to be.
Jay Leininger is a senior scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity. He says unprecedented loopholes undermine the Endangered Species Act's protection for the lesser prairie chicken. A cancer cluster is a term used by public health workers to define an outbreak of a greater than expected number of cancer cases to a certain area. When there is a suspicion of a cancer cluster, state health workers will do a study to look to see if the number of cancer cases are greater than what would be statistically understandable for that area. That's what happened in Flower Mound, Texas. The concern was that the fracking of the Barnett Shale in the vicinity was releasing benzene into the neighborhoods, and there was an increase in the number of children diagnosed with leukemia and lymphoma. The Texas Department of State Health Services conducted studies and declared there was no cancer cluster. But a new reexamination of that same study by an independent third party has a different conclusion, that there is a high probability that there is a cancer cluster and that more health studies are needed, along with increased air quality monitoring and regulation of air pollution in the Barnett Shale. Rochelle Rawlings is a law school lecturer and a researcher at the University of Texas at Austin. She published the report last week in the Virginia Environmental Law Journal.
I wrote an article that looks at the mismatch between the details of the existing regulatory system and the risks revealed by the existing science. The contribution's really in law, not in science. But as part of this research, we did produce a statistical analysis, a reanalysis of state data in Flower Mound, which I understand is of concern for our conversation today.
Yeah, so in Flower Mound, they have what some people have described as a cancer cluster. Do we know for sure that there is a cancer cluster there?
Well, what the state did was conclude that it was not 99% certain that there is a cancer cluster. When we reworked this data using the more standard 95% confidence interval, when we saw that the rates of childhood leukemia and childhood non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in Flower Mound were significantly higher than expected, and at the 95th percent confidence interval, that means there's only a 1 in 20 chance that the difference is random. And it's fairly standard in science to use that confidence interval.
So in Flower Mound, there were children that were having incidence of cancer. But the one thing is one thing to assign a causation for it.
Yes.
But it's another thing to actually determine that there was a actual, you know, high level of cancer in that community.
And our study does not assign causation. I looked at the state's analysis, and I saw that the state dismissed doing a detailed study because it was not 99% sure, if you will, that the rates were significantly elevated in ways that were not related to chance. No, they used the 99th percent confidence interval to be 99% sure that there's a problem before we investigate further. And when they did that, they didn't look at geographic areas or or they didn't look at the timing of gas industry operations to see if there was a correlation with the location and timing of these cases relating to gas industry operations. But that actually is the question that was being posed by the community. The community reached out to the state, requested a cancer cluster study. This is how I understand it, that there were parents who thought there were too many cases of cancer, suspected or were worried about a possible association with gas industry emissions, asked the state to come in and study the issue. And I think the state was rather quick to dismiss their concerns. And even when the state found with 99% certainty that there were elevated rates of breast cancer, it still didn't look carefully at the location and timing of those cases in relation to gas industry emissions.
You're using the same data that the state used.
We're using exactly the same data. We took their data, put it into a spreadsheet, and reworked the numbers with a different confidence interval, a different level of assurance. And I am not an expert in statistical analysis. My research assistant initially brought this issue to my attention, and I called on Dr. Maria Morandi. She's at the Center for Environmental Health Sciences at the University of Montana. She was recommended to me by a UT professor. I asked her if she could review and confirm the analysis, and that is an additional layer of carefulness, if you will. I called on Lauren Ross, who I've worked with in the past. She has a PhD in environmental engineering, and her dissertation focused on statistical methods. And she also reviewed this data and confirmed that we are seeing, during this time period, we are seeing significantly more cases than expected of these types of childhood cancer. And again, the state already acknowledged that it was 99% certain that there were increased rates of breast cancer. Now, the state said that was likely, the breast cancer at least, was likely explained by population growth, but actually the data and the charts that are included in the state study show only a 41% increase in population. That's from 98 to 2008, yet breast cancer rates tripled during this period. The state also acknowledged or noted in its study that, and I'm going to quote this, it said, research does not show a link between breast cancer risk and environmental pollutants. Yet EPA, in its Integrated Risk Information System, does identify breast cancer as one of the cancers that may be associated with benzene. So, my thought was, well, with results like this, wouldn't she want to do further analysis and look at the location and timing of cases in relation to environmental contaminants?
You took the state's study, and you found it to be lacking.
Well, I found it to be cursory. It's not incorrect in that it's true. At the 99th percent confidence interval, the state did not find significantly elevated rates of these cancers. I just question whether we should have a public discussion about the level of certainty that's appropriate to use in studies like this. Choosing the 99th percentile if you choose that level of certainty, what you're doing is you're being very careful not to make an error that mistakenly finds a cancer cluster when really it's just chance.
And so it seems
like it's very protective of industry using this level of protection. Using this confidence interval.
Really what it comes down to is 99% sure versus 95% sure, right?
Yes.
95% sure is more aligned with what people would say would be the standard.
Yes, and not only that, but 95% sure. If we're 95% sure we have a problem, should we investigate? We're 95% sure that the rates of childhood leukemia in flower mound are higher than they should be, higher than expected. Should we investigate? We're 95% sure there's a problem. Is that sure enough to warrant an investigation, a careful investigation?
And at 99% sure is a dismissal. It's like,
yes,
there's nothing here, nothing to look at, folks.
Exactly.
And so
exactly.
You're saying we need to look at, there is something to look at. Let's ask more questions. Let's do some more examinations.
Right, because not only were these data showing that we are 95% sure that they're elevated cases. But that was using the state's units of analysis. When the state studied the city as a whole and large zip code areas, it didn't actually go in and look at the neighborhood of concern. Where are the gas industry emissions? How far do those plumes travel? What is the precise geographic area that we should look at? So by looking at large areas, they tend to dilute the data.
So you've spoken to some of the leaders of Flower Mound recently. They wanted an update on where you are on the study and what was their reaction.
Well, they were concerned that they understand the results and what our findings were, and we had a conversation about sort of the meaning of this. The point of my work isn't so much to look backward. It's really to look forward. Texas has long recognized that it needs to track public health in relation to environmental exposure. It just hasn't really done a good job of trying to create a systematic approach to do that.
What happens now? I mean, the state has their study. Now you have your results. There's a difference, but
Well, you know, part of this isn't really it's not that our results are different. It's that I am suggesting that the state should look more carefully, even when it's not positive, there's a problem. In science, it's very hard to get certainty. In science, we rarely use the 99th percent confidence interval. That's a very, very high level of certainty. So if it's normal in science to rely on the 95th percent confidence interval to do further study when you're 95% sure there's a problem, perhaps we should change the way we approach these health effect studies. And that's really my point. It's not that the state study is wrong. It's that the state is quickly dismissive and not doing careful analysis.
Well, the study can be completely correct, but the conclusion that the state makes based on the study can be out of alignment. So, and that's what people are dependent on, are the conclusions and how we're going to use that information going forward. And so if the state says, you know, there's nothing here, and you're saying, yeah, there might be, we need to take a closer look, then that's something of importance to the people who are directly impacted by the air contamination, and maybe someone in their family got one of these cancers, and they want answers.
Yes.
So what happens now?
I think there's a request for the state to comment. That was my understanding from my conversation with representatives from Flower Mound. And as a researcher, my paper suggests that we try to set up a better system. My paper speaks to more than just Flower Mound, and we didn't.
It's about
mean
the entire
to,
system. Is what you're talking about?
Yes, we didn't mean to say that there's. We didn't evaluate the error monitor. Air quality monitoring or regulatory system in Flower Mound. That was not the purpose of our work, was not to point a finger at Flower Mound. What we looked at and evaluated was how the state approaches health effects analysis.
Rochelle Rawlings is a law school lecturer and researcher at the University of Texas at Austin. She published a report last week in the Virginia Environmental Law Journal that re-examines the Texas Department of State Health Services study of a suspected cancer cluster in Flower Mound, Texas. She found a high probability that there is a cancer cluster. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. We'd like to hear from you, and you can write us an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. And you can write directly on our show page at our website at tpr.org. That's also where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. And you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.